Du lytter til Solveig Speisa musikk på Radio Rakel FM 99,3. Mitt navn Solveig Sørbø, min tekniker heter Guse, og min gjest I dag Victor Gonzalez. Velkommen, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm so happy to have you here in the studio. I've been really wanting you to be part of this show for some time. And you are an engineer and music researcher and work with exciting things, which we're going to learn about soon. Yeah, so tell me about your background and how you ended up doing music research.
Yeah, well, I'm a mechanical engineer, as you said. I come from Mexico, but I did my PhD in the UK, in Sheffield. But yeah, my background is mechanical engineer from the Mexican National University. And I ended up doing music research, even though I've never played an instrument. That's interesting, yeah. It started by, I was just finishing my PhD and I was just looking for new projects. And I found this project by one of your former guests, Alexander Erefsum Jensenius.
Are you do you have a PhD in engineering?
Yeah, in mechanical engineering. It's in biomechanics, actually.
So then it's more related to the body.
Yeah, it's how we use mechanical engineering to measure human movement. So using physics to study how we move and why we move the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
And how our bodies work to produce these movements. So that was what I did as PhD research in the UK. It was actually on hand movement. So I was studying how we do things with our hands, how our fingers coordinate to do very small things or bigger things.
How is that?
Well, it's a very complex study. I mean, it's still something that people keep wondering about, because how we learn to do these things so automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it that happens to us when we are suddenly unable to do it, like when we have arthritis or other conditions that might stop us from doing these things so easily. So I was looking at people drinking from a cup of water and then just comparing them, like someone with a healthy person drinking, reaching and grasping a glass and drinking, versus someone who cannot do that. And we don't really think about those things when we are healthy.
Yeah.
We just do them, and we don't think the amount of how much we move our fingers for everything. Also, when we speak, we move our hands, we move our fingers.
Mm-hmm.
We use gestures, and we really don't think about those. And how do we put my thumb so that the glass is balanced? And how do I grasp this thing? How do I grasp this hammer?
Mm-hmm.
How do I write with a pencil? We don't think about those things. And then suddenly, there's a lot of people who cannot do that and who have to think of new strategies to do it or cannot do it at all.
Yeah.
And it has to do with how the fingers coordinate, how we move. I mean, the fingers are super complex structures. And the body is a super complex structure. How we are able to control that, it's something that we are still not being able to fully comprehend.
Mm.
So that was my PhD on. And then I found this project on, even though I never played an instrument, I always loved music, listening to music.
Mm.
And I saw this project description on music and movement. And I just thought it was perfect for me. And I just applied for that. And
but that didn't have anything to do with the hand, or did it?
I understood it as it had something to do, because the way I read the proposal and how I interpreted it was music and movement in a more general. So I was thinking about musicians playing.
Right.
So I was thinking about using our hands to play music.
Mm.
And also the type of technologies that they wanted to use in the project, that's the same technologies I was using for studying hand movement. Then the project was more on how we respond to music, not so much on how we play it.
Yeah.
So how our bodies respond to music, and that's the name. The project was called Micro, and very small movements to music. But using the same technologies, infrared cameras, to track very accurately.
There are some of these movements also in the hands, or more like in the torso?
For this project, it was like whole body movement. Mm-hmm. But like, again, it's the same. I was doing the same experiments almost in terms of attaching small reflective spheres to the body.
Yeah, so motion.
Motion capture. Mm. Yeah. So I was doing that for biomechanics, and then I was doing that for just asking people to stand still and listen to music, mm-hmm. and then seeing at how much they move, even though we ask them not to move.
Yeah, I think maybe Agata Zelechowska also spoke about that here.
Yeah, yeah. Her PhD was also related. Based on that topic, on the same project. So we were working on how people move to music, even though they are asked not to move to music. And we play different types of music. Normally music that they don't really know of, but still like electronic dance music.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you actually do the analysis, like when you have motion capture data, which would look like just a lot of blotches in space. I mean, you will be adding these reflective markers to key points on the body, right? Mm. But how do you actually analyze it? Because I've seen like little loops that are drawing how the arm was moving in space. Mm. And I just think it must be so, so hard to find something that makes sense out of that kind of information.
Yeah, it's not that difficult to make sense of it. Because what we see, what people normally see from motion capture and what's used for movies and video games is this 3D animation, let's say. Mm-hmm. But in order for the computer to get that animation, there is information on the position of these dots in space. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what we use. So strictly speaking, we don't really look at how it looks, the 3D on space. We look at the numbers behind them. So so we establish a zero coordinate in the lab.
Right.
And then from that zero coordinate, then we know where each point that is attached to the body is. Mm-hmm. And then we know, like, I don't know, if someone is 1 meter, 80 centimeters tall and has a marker on the top of their head, we know that that marker is 180 tall. And we have the same all across the body.
Right.
So we use those and we know how much, I mean, we know where they move and how they move in time. So we use that. That's the information that we use. Those are the numbers that we process to get how fast you move, how high you jump, or how precise you were playing a key in a keyboard, because we've done that too.
Mm. Cool. And you have some music with you today.
Yeah.
What have you brought?
Well, there was it's Latin American music.
Yeah.
That I really like. When I was growing up, I was not so fond of them, of this type of music. But as I grew old, I started to appreciate that. So when I was growing up, I was more into like English-speaking popular music. But then I started to like it more and more. The older I grow, the more I like Spanish-speaking music, and especially this type of music. It's two of them are very danceable in Latin America, where I come from. Mm-hmm. It's a genre called cumbia, with a lot of African influences as well. And the first two songs I suggested, they are Peruvian cumbia songs. Mm-hmm. Peruvian cumbia is special in that it's also a bit psychedelic. They call it psychedelic cumbia as well.
Oh.
We can hear it and then we'll see.
Okay, so what's the name of this one so that Guse can find it?
I can't remember what was the first one.
Okay, play the first one.
But I can probably figure it out.
Punay, Punay, devuélveme, devuélveme, mi pastorcita perdida. Aunque tenga en esta vida que viento y tierra tragar.
So beautiful. I'd like to keep having that voice inside my head for a long time. Nice. Yeah.
It was not really a cumbia. Sorry, the other was a bit... I couldn't remember what was the first one, but this is an Argentinian folk singer.
Oh.
Yes.
I was trying to imagine how to dance to it.
Yeah, I was also actually... I mean, you could. One could, but it's not... this is not the cumbia. This singer, he's of Native American or Native South American origins also.
Mm-hmm. What's his name?
Atahualpa Yupanqui. So he was a very one of the most famous Argentinian folk musicians.
Mm.
And this song is about a shepherd that gets lost in the Andes Mountains.
Mm.
So Pastorcita Perdida, that's lost shepherd, lost little shepherd.
Pastor.
Yeah, pastor is a shepherd.
Oh, really?
So Pastorcita is female little shepherd.
Mm.
And the singer is trying, he wants to find her somewhere in the mountains, in the Andean mountains in Argentina.
Yeah, I hope he finds her.
Yeah, hopefully he did. Yeah, but I really like this one. I use it a lot when I need some peace and quiet.
Yeah, it's very comforting in a way.
Yeah, it is.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why I suggested it.
Mm. Very nice. A little bit more about your research.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this project on how we moved to music, that was not the only thing I did at the University of Oslo, where I don't know if I mentioned it, it was there. But and then I was also working with other researchers on this part that I thought I was supposed to do originally, which was how we play music.
Yeah.
So okay. How we move when we play music, and how we, the same way I was studying before, how we learn to, or how we learn to grasp a glass of water.
Mm-hmm.
More daily life things. Here I was studying how we learn to play an instrument, how we become experts.
Yeah.
So we were looking at students, music students, and their instructors and their teachers. And we were using the same motion capture technology on them. So we had the teacher and their students.
But do you put also reflecting markers on the hand instead?
Yeah, we were the same on the hands, on the arms,
mm-hmm.
on the head. We were focusing on cello.
Mm.
We had a colleague, a researcher, who is also a cello instructor himself. So we had him and his students also at the lab playing at different levels, a more intermediate student, a very young student. We were using not only motion capture, but also muscle technologies. It's called electromyography.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the electric impulses that activate our muscles.
Mm.
So that's how we control movement through these impulses.
Do you have more rapid impulses if you're engaging in an activity that involves the fingers? And
yeah, it's not so much about speed of impulses, but more how they are structured.
Okay.
Which,
How are they structured? Tell me all the details.
Well, because all of this comes from signals from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is about brain plasticity and how our brain learns to move our body differently.
Mm-hmm.
And how practice helps our brain control these electric impulses in a different way so that we can perform these very accurate, very fast movements in a way.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot about, sometimes it's very fine strategies that, depending on the instrument, they learn how to move the fingers at a certain speed that we don't normally do. Like, so when playing the piano or playing the cello, there are some finger movements that we are not, if you're not a musician, maybe you don't do or you are not used to do. So they have to learn these strategies. How do we achieve this speed of movement with the fingers? What's the most physical, the optimal, physically speaking, the optimal way of moving the fingers so fast.
But is that enough information, like getting the electromyography from the muscles, or wouldn't you also need to measure the brain somehow?
Yeah, there's also research on that. We didn't do that, but there is also research on how the signal starts from the brain, of course. So this is more how the signal reaches the muscle fibers, and then the muscles are the ones moving the bones, and then the bones are the ones. So that's what we see.
Mm.
So we were looking at the difference is how the muscles are activated differently between novices and experts, and the process of how we get this that we call fluency, how one becomes fluent at playing an instrument.
Yeah.
And it also varies a lot. What we realized, we did some experiments on drummers as well, and it's a completely different thing. I mean, it's still music, and there's things that are in common between playing the drums and playing the cello. Mm-hmm. But the way we move to achieve both, it differs. Because the amplitude of movement is different. For cello, it's mostly like wrist movement, finger movement. For drums, there is a lot of more whole arm movement. There is more torso displacement when we are playing the drums.
Mm.
So there, it's there are very different cases that we studied. We also looked at piano playing a bit, but we focused on cello and drums, and there's still a lot of data that we haven't analyzed, actually.
But how did you find that the, what did you say, that the muscle signals are organized, or like, can you tell a bit more in detail, maybe? So I'd like to understand.
Yeah, so this is I think a bit more complex than the motion capture data. This data is a bit more noisy also, so it's difficult. It requires more work to extract valuable information from this. When you look at the data, this electric data, it looks like noise.
Okay.
A lot. So you have to clean it out and extract just the frequencies of this noise that are characteristic of human movement, or in this case of motor control. And then from that you compare like different muscles, because we know which muscle moves certain fingers and which muscles extend the arm and which muscles flex the arm. So we put the sensors on those locations where here we will track electric activity from this muscle that we know only extends the arm.
Yeah.
And then we compare that, how quickly or how the arm is extending versus when it flexes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's agonist-antagonist behavior of the muscles.
Yeah.
And then how they coordinate each other, how often we flex and extend arms. Mm. The same we do with fingers, how often we flex and extend fingers.
Yeah.
Looking at this electrical activity, how they, this as we became, as they become experts, they start to do this in a more natural manner, how they flex and extend the fingers or abduct and adduct. This is the lateral kind of movement.
Is that seen more like, do they, for instance, get a more gradual mix of flex and extend, or like is it? Because I think I remember when I was dancing a lot that you would be engaging muscles on both sides. You would you wouldn't really drop one side entirely.
Exactly.
Is it a bit like that with?
Yeah, it's about one of the conclusions, or that's also perhaps general knowledge, but it's about being efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, of course, your arm doesn't just fall dead when you stop, when you change from one technique to another. Mm. So you have to be able to control also, like with drumming, for example, the rebound.
Yeah.
They use a lot of these rapid movements, of this trigger, of this impulse, when you just let gravity do its thing with a drumstick.
Yeah.
But you also have to be able to control the rebound and to be able to use it again in your favor.
And then to switch quickly between these functions. Between
positions and different grips. And so it's about being efficient. Mm. And also being natural to avoid injury, which is also one of the objectives of this project, to study why musicians get injuries.
And also like to relax the muscles that you don't need to use.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah, and there are muscles that maybe, and that's something that we got from instructors, that it's for them sometimes difficult. Sometimes they see, just by looking at the student, it seems like the technique is the correct one.
Mm.
They are still doing something wrong that they maybe cannot see why, and it's because they are maybe tensing or using too much of some part of the body that they shouldn't be using.
So is this useful, like, to if you want to have a healthy career as a musician and not get tendonitis, for instance? Could you be like for instance, could you be using this EMG sensors, and then you would say, wow, you're really too tense, this is gonna give you tendonitis in the long run, or can it be used these ways as well?
It was one of the long term or mid term objectives of this type of projects, to use technology enhanced learning.
Yeah.
So how can we use this to help teaching and learning? And there was also some virtual reality involved there as well. How can we simulate without being at the stage or in a proper performance? How can we simulate these scenarios and then get data from musicians in these scenarios, at least virtually? And musicians, we're talking about student, aspiring musicians maybe, so that they start experiencing some of this, and then we see how the body is responding to this and how they are improving or worsening.
But I'm wondering, like, I mean, you learn a lot from an instructor just by, like, modeling them. And so how important is it that the instructor has a healthy technique themselves?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's, I mean, I never took instrument lessons. So
no.
but we know that, I mean, it is key that the instructor is also aware of this and aware of, that. I mean, I think most of them probably are, I don't know, of the, like, it can be, it's very easy to get injured with this. I mean, especially these are very repetitive actions. someone who's studying this every day or 3 days a week, and also under stress and from a young age.
Yeah.
So this is also part of the body development, and so we need to be aware of these things to prevent injury, and especially there are many long-term injuries that can affect life afterwards if they don't have the right technique.
Wow. I actually got to try a new instrument yesterday. It was a santur. It's a Persian instrument, because I was meeting up with a great santur player and composer is called Mir Said. I can't remember his family name because he's a very new contact, but he allowed me to play it, and it was a lot about using a different kind of movement than I'm used to.
The percussion instrument.
Yeah, it's a melodic percussion. It has a lot of strings and some kind of thin sticks or hammers that are dressed with felt, and then you have to keep on, what is this movement called?
abduction.
with the wrists, and I felt so helpless. But he said it's a good first try, and it's exactly the kind of thing I could have done in your lab, I guess, and see how my inefficient movement would have turned gradually more efficient by trying it over and over again.
Because we were looking at efficient movements and the sound they produce, because that's also important. I mean, the outcome, what they want, is to sound good. So we had also music experts on the team that were looking at, okay, how is the sound? Is there any differences in the sound that correlate with this specific muscle activation strategies? There's something that we can see in the sound that corresponds to this activity.
But isn't that so cool? I mean, like, you get a better sound when you do a healthy movement. How come? Are we just lucky?
it's efficiency, I guess. It's kind of natural to be efficient, and then
how do you define efficiency?
Well, reduced use of the energy. The most anatomical appropriate movements also, because that our body is designed in a way to be in a way. So if we use our joints, our muscles, our bones to move the way our body is designed to, that's kind of being efficient in a way. Yeah. That's how we can get the most out of our bodies.
But it's not always like that. Hitting a drum harder with more energy makes it sound better, right?
No, so exactly.
I'm wondering about, is a mysterious connection there?
Yeah, it has to do with many things, with the precision, also with the timing, of course.
Yeah.
So that's also something that we were looking at, on the timing of these events and how we are able to do it precise and at the right moment.
Yeah.
With the right amount of energy.
Mm.
So there are many factors involved, of course, and if that produces the sound we want. And if there is also, if there are instances where the sound is good, but then you look at the movement and you see it's all wrong, or there's something that could induce injury.
Yeah. Wow, cool. Should we listen to some more music then?
Yeah. Let's
about the right one, or the first one, I mean.
Yeah, that would make sense. The one that is is for dancing.
The one
of the cumbia ones.
Let's
hear it.
I think I got it right this time.
Latin American music, and you're listening to Solveig Spesa Music still. And Victor Gonzalez, you have to tell me a little bit more about this song and who was performing it.
Yeah, this is a Peruvian band called Los Mirlos. It's Mirlos is a type of bird, and the song is Cumbia de los Pajaritos, the bird's cumbia. You can see at the beginning there was some birds singing.
Right.
So it's an old cumbia, very old. Very old, from the 60s maybe, 70s. Each country has their own kind of style of cumbia now. Mm. And Peruvian cumbia developed into this kind of psychedelic with the guitar there.
Is it a couples dance or a single?
Couples.
Or a group? Yeah,
it's a couples dance. It has a very specific technique to dance. Mm-hmm. But it's very common, especially like in Latin American countries, it's considered like the dance of the poor ones.
Right.
And that's how they call it, literally. So it's like people who from the favelas or equivalent in Latin America. They normally you grow up dancing to this, and New Year's, every event, there is some cumbia there and there's people dancing. But again, each country developed their own kind of style of cumbia.
Mm-hmm.
The Peruvian one is perhaps my favorite.
Yeah, very nice. And how come? What do you mean with that? That is psychedelic?
Well, they call it a psychedelic cumbia themselves. They added these guitar riffs there with this reverb there. Sounds a bit psychedelic. They do more guitar solos. They were influenced a lot by this psychedelic movement in the 60s and 70s.
Okay, but is it linked to some kind of a ritual or
yeah,
smoking or anything like that as well?
Yeah, probably. I'm not familiar with that so much, but I think it might be. Mm-hmm. In other countries, it has no association with psychedelia. It's just in Peru for some reason, and Bolivia, I think, which could make sense.
And maybe the guitar sound and like the continuous rhythm is also kind of hypnotic in a way in itself.
Yeah, I don't know. It might have some.
Some kind of effect on the mind. Yeah, it was very nice.
Mm.
Just to come back to the research, I mean, we were talking about how you were studying how people learn to play an instrument and become efficient. And I was wondering if this also has applications when it comes to rehabilitation, when people say if they have lost one of these movement skills that you said, by maybe a stroke or maybe they have a disease.
Mm-hmm.
Is this relevant as well as,
There's a boom now on music therapy in many aspects, and one is movement rehabilitation, and using for people with Parkinson's disease. It's something that's been studied a lot recently on how music triggers movement.
Yeah, because that's what you said. It even if you're trying to stand still, it will trigger a little bit.
Yeah, and for some, I mean, there is a lot of popular science videos and articles that you can read about how music triggers, like someone who's with Parkinson's, you have these freeze moments when you suddenly cannot move, even in the middle of a walk, and how music has helped. It has been shown to help some patients to overcome this freezing by exciting some areas of the brain that help with movement.
Have they used the same the EMG sensors for that as well? Or
yeah, they have to study this. They have used EMG and other movement analysis techniques, but also ECG, like the brain sensor, head tracking sensors.
And do they get more efficient as well? Like what happened when they were studying an instrument?
I guess it's not really being more efficient here. It's more about rehabilitating areas of the brain that are no longer functioning as they should, and then. It's because everything in like how we activate movement, as I mentioned, it's about impulses and electric impulses in our brains and in our muscles.
Yeah.
So it's about giving the right impulse and the right spark. So I see it as music kind of sparks the areas of the brain or the muscles that needed to be sparked in order for the movement to happen.
And it goes, I mean, just to understand like where the information moves, does it go through the ear and then the brain and to the muscle, or is also some of it directly like to the body? Is that...
Well, we were studying something like that because especially when we listen to music that with a strong bass sound, lower sounds, that we not only listen to, but we also feel it.
Right.
So how that affects like physically, it moves you physically. You don't need to listen to it to be moved.
Yeah, it might even be so deep that you can't hear it,
but
you would still get moved.
Yeah, so that, I don't know if that has been used for Parkinson's disease, for example.
Yeah,
because what I've seen, for example, is using cumbia, for example, to make people move, or some music that they are very fond of. That you know that person is very fond of, and then you put it, and then they suddenly can move.
Yeah.
So that happens, and it has also been used in Alzheimer's research on triggering memories, and that is kind of the similar effect on just sparking something that suddenly they can't remember something. They can't remember events or even more than that, just by, because of a song or a piece of music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the healing power of music. Wow, so nice. Do you want to talk a little bit more about research or about something else?
Yeah, well, this on music therapy and music and research for music therapy, this is not so far from what I'm doing now after I left my position at the University of Oslo. So now I work in at SINTEF in Oslo, in Norway, doing research on health and performance.
Yeah.
And this is more technology-based. It's more on how we use sensors or other technologies to measure health and performance, but also how we use them to help with health and performance. But in a way, it's also, I mean, I'm looking also at people with movement impairments and how we can improve their lives. So it kind of closed the circle in a way for my research, and from just pure movement to music and movement, and now like movement, more applied research and human movement.
Mm-hmm.
But using a lot of this, and there is possible, I mean, one of my projects is, it will be on music therapy as well, and looking at this exactly, at how can we trigger movement from music, from specific types of music, and how can we, especially how, one thing is to know that it does, and then how can we implement it so that patients or people can actually use it, not only at hospitals, but maybe at home.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we use existing technologies to make this accessible to people?
Yeah, what can be some examples?
Well, there is a lot of, on for example, having devices at home now with Internet of Things that connect between themselves. So how can we keep track of
like
a person?
Google Home and things like that.
Yeah. Or other more clinically tested where we also know that the data is protected and not shared or used for commercial purposes.
Mm.
So some clinically developed devices to track someone's movements in their homes, and then detecting if they are at risk of falling, or if they have Parkinson's disease, if they have a freezing event, and then activating something that either in a smartphone or in a smartwatch that triggers these movements again, or that prevents them from, helping them not to fall, or if they already fail, how can we call urgent emergency services?
Okay.
Or keep their physicians updated.
But in the case of Parkinson's, it could actually be that if they have a freezing moment, then music could be triggered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of music would that be, ideally?
Well, that could be customized, I guess. It depends.
Yeah,
on
something that I like.
It's still to be like validated. What is it exactly that makes us move?
Maybe
again,
some songs would be better suited.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that needs to be. That's the part that needs to be developed. What exactly can we use more consistently to attack this problem?
Mm.
There is research on visual stimuli, on using like more like a laser pointing from your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you freeze, you see the laser, this laser dot on the floor,
mm-hmm,
where your next step should be, and it's proved to be helping. Like that helps already. Just look at this is where I should step, and then they are able to make the step.
Right. Okay.
So it's on this making this more accessible and just applying it.
How do you detect that somebody's about to fall?
Well, we look at balance. So our bodies also are very particular in the way they control balance. If you think about it, we are standing on two legs, and it's even like if you have a doll and you put it on two legs, the doll will normally fall.
Yeah, I remember I was trying that when I was a little girl. I was like, why can't
there
it
were
stand?
Many dolls. They didn't think about that so often. These toy makers, I remember, I was also frustrated by my toys not being able to stand.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot going on in our bodies to keep us in an upward position.
Mm.
And we can track this the center of mass of our bodies and see how it's outside of the base of support, we call it.
Yeah.
So there is this point, if you imagine a point like around your abdomen, and we see how this point is moving in space, and if it's too much out of our base of support, we call it, then we know that a fall is coming.
Yeah.
But we can also detect things that are not normal in walking, how we walk.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of studies on how humans walk,
mm-hmm,
and then what's abnormal walk, So if we detect that, okay, this person is not walking properly, there's too short steps or too long steps, or this
too wide,
or this foot is not raising high enough, then we can also see that there is risk of falling, that anything could bring them down.
So. Is that sometimes, I mean, is typically the patient aware, or could this be something that happens before they notice it?
It could be that it depends on how it happens, but many times they are just, that's how they live basically now. They just, it's the way they walk now, and then the risk is high. And then we just have to be more precise on detecting, okay, they normally walk like this, but today or this event in particular was more prone to being a fall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also done again with sensors. Now with the new wearable technologies, we are able to have, even from data from the phone, we can get a lot of these walking parameters. So from the phone, we can see how often the steps happen, and the frequency of the steps, and the step length. Many of these things we can get just from the phone in your pocket.
Yeah. So it will just first learn what is your typical behavior. How long time does it take for a device to learn your typical behavior?
Yeah, in this case, we could be thinking of using some pre-trained models that already know how like the human works. A human.
Yeah,
or a human with a certain condition that we know of.
Works.
And then from there, scaling down to, or specifying it more to this person that is wearing this device.
Yeah.
And then learning their habits, and if, okay, this is not a fall, this is, even though it's 11 a.m., they are in bed. Because that's also one way of detecting it, just if the person is on the floor. So that's after the fall happened, and then what can we do about it?
Well, like it would seem like they're in bed, but then you will find it strange that they're in bed at that time.
Yeah,
we can see the position,
if the body position is kind of, especially with people in home care.
Yeah.
We know that this person is vulnerable, and then we know that if they are lying down at 2 p.m., then that's maybe a fall.
Yeah.
That compared with other data, of course, if we have more data, the more data we have, the more we are able to tell with precision.
And it's a way of monitoring people, but it's in a way much less invasive than, say, a camera, right? Yeah. So.
I mean, all of this comes with the fact that, I mean, we do need to share. I mean, this needs to be shared with the researchers or with the medical team. So that's one of the challenges of this type of research, is that we need to be very careful with this data.
Yeah. I mean, it's anyway only people who would like to try it.
Yeah. Yeah. But even then, there's a lot of security going on how we treat this data, and that the person is not identifiable.
Yeah.
The medical kind of application.
Yeah.
And there is research on using video, because there's so much on image processing now that we can do with machine learning and deep learning now.
Oh.
On using video to just do the same that motion capture does, just with a normal camera, with your smartphone camera now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then, of course, does that mean that we need to be recording a person in their house? So that's not maybe. So it depends on, maybe in hospitals. I think it's been tested on hospitals sometimes, in hospital rooms.
Yeah.
So track some vital signs just with a camera.
Yeah.
And respiratory patterns.
Well, if that's what you need to keep someone alive, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to show us another song?
Yeah, let's go for it. I don't know if it's another cumbia.
Okay.
Sácalo, lindita.
More danceable dance music from Peru there. Well, what was this one?
Sácalo.
Yeah?
Take it out.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't say much than that. So it's much more than that. So it's just danceable.
Take out whatever you want to take out.
Yeah.
For interpretation.
Yeah. It's whatever you want to take out.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, that's the strength of music. It doesn't have to be bound to language, right? Just take it out, dance it, drop it. Tell me more about them. Tell me more about sensors.
Yeah, well, that's most of my days now are about just working with sensors. more than ever, maybe. Because as we've talked about, I was working mostly with motion capture and this electromyography on muscles. And now that I'm working with applied technologies on health, I'm using sensors, other types of sensors, all kinds of sensors almost. And by sensors, we mean something that takes some physical event or parameter and transforms it into something that we can interpret or do something with.
Yeah, numbers.
Numbers. So it can be from sound sensor or image sensor, a camera. But it can also be like a breathing sensor. So can we? How do we extract numbers from the way we breathe? And then it can be done in many things. Sensors can be made in many things, in many ways. So a breathing sensor can be based on just how our bodies, our chests expand when we breathe. But it can also be based on the oxygen intake or how the air flows into our lungs. So we,
and maybe also like the values in the blood.
Yeah, of course, the oximeter. So there's, I mean, that's sensors. And one of the good things about sensors now is that they are very affordable. They are smaller and smaller. We can do more things with them. We have huge storage capabilities now. We can store a lot of data from these sensors. And we can also store them in smaller physical memories. So they can also be more portable. So they are small, they are portable. There's many of them, and they are very powerful and fast. So your phone has dozens of sensors, and your smartwatches have them, and many headphones have. I mean, they are everywhere now. And
a lot of instruments as well are more and more sensor-based. Like there's this electrical saxophone thing. Which is, I think, is air sensors, but it turns your breath into insane synthesizer sounds, and you can just
We did some work
and the theremin.
The theremin,
older example.
We did some work on that, on what they call augmented acoustic instruments. So using sensors, I don't know if Alexander mentioned that when he was here, but there was that was a parallel project that we were running on putting sensors on instruments and trying to augment them. And especially on acoustic instruments, so an acoustic guitar with sensors that see how your arm is movement, and then not only you play the strings, but also the accelerometer on the guitar is also like augmenting the sound somehow of the guitar, or on a violin or on a keyboard, using some infrared sensors on a keyboard that you're playing the keys, but you're also using the sensors to increase the sound.
Is this related at all to Chare Erdem's research?
Yeah, of course.
Because he's coming another week, just so you know, guys.
Yeah, you can talk to him. he knows about these things.
Cool.
So using, and this comes not only using your movement, but also, as I mentioned, there is this electromyography on muscle activity he uses. Chare can talk about that. He using muscle activity to play music.
Yeah, I didn't say you shouldn't talk about it. You can talk about what you want.
So this just using sensors on instruments as the same way as we use it for tracking how fast you're running, or if you're training enough, or if you're sitting for too long, or if, and the same way companies are tracking us to see what we like. And
maybe one day you can just like open your clinic, people can come by and just say, oh, in your clinic it's called like censor me. And then I come in and just, and then I will just say, Victor Gonzalez, can you just censor me? Tell me all my problems.
Yeah,
I think I need a couple of those sensors to tell me everything I need to do.
and we make Victor rich.
We might need more than two sensors.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's everywhere now, and everyone is kind of on this boom on sensors and wearable technologies, and how can we make the most out of it. There is also, again, the negative part or the not so cool part of using it for commercial, purely commercial purposes. And
yeah,
I mean, this is still information about our bodies. And when we're talking about connectivity, then this means that our data from how we move or how we breathe or how our heart works might be in the cloud and accessible by others.
Maybe we should just not have them in the smartphone.
Maybe. Or have more control on that, on how we allow companies access to these things.
That's a big issue.
Yeah. So this is actually one of the biggest challenges now on this, is not so much on the technology, because it exists and it's developing fast. It's more about how do we use it properly and how do we prevent people from not using it properly. And I mean, there's a lot of institutions trying to get some norms on how do we share data, what do we do with patients' data, how it should be stored, who has mm-hmm. access to it and who doesn't, how to anonymize data, what's anonymized data even.
Mm.
We're talking about something, if it's from your phone and it's a number, there's a number there, there's a name to your phone.
Mm.
The data coming from that phone is perfectly identifiable. So it's this one, perhaps the biggest challenge. The technology is there and we can do many good things with it, but can we do it without affecting, without invading too much on,
mm.
or at all on people's lives or on their privacy?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're working also on now. And there's even a department on where I work now on just looking at these things and how do we increase security and make this more safer for patients and for the public in general and less accessible to big companies.
Well, it's great that you're taking responsibility on that part as well in CINTEF, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of also what we did in this music lab project at
mm-hmm.
UIO as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where we were just an instrument.
Where I know you from.
Yeah, where we met.
Mm.
So it's putting sensors on audience members.
Mm.
But with this perspective in mind, of course, on data and privacy and security. And
there is totally anonymized
data. Mm. And, but also making use of the fact that sensors are small and that they give us so much information. So can we learn more of how or why people enjoy music or enjoy a performance in general?
Mm.
And what makes a performance enjoyable for the audience? What I mean, all these things that can be studied in a...
What do you know so far?
Well, we've been like one of the main findings in one of these events was just how groups affect people, how people standing in groups or sitting in groups were moving more to the music, or how people who were closer to the musician were perhaps breathing in more in synchronization with the musician or with the performer in this case.
So proximity to the musician and also to other audience members with the and that does that mean that it makes your experience richer or anything? Is that what it means?
It could mean that. I mean, we all know it, all we know is that the breathing was in sync with the musician's breathing. We don't know if that relates to a more enjoyable performance, or it's not that clear yet.
Yeah.
But we know that something is going on when people are sitting in groups. And it also was different if they were sitting in groups just because they ended up being there, or if they were with friends or with family.
Yeah, it could be many reasons, right?
Yeah.
And but you ask them, of course,
if they enjoyed it. Yeah, we have that as well. I mean, we know there is a relation if they were their friends or they were just random people that they ended up sitting with. That has an effect.
Oh, it's a better effect if they're friends.
Yeah, yeah. If you know them, if you're familiar with them.
Mm.
Helps with at least with this synchronization effect that we observed, but there's much to be done yet to claim any of this to be fully scientific.
Yeah.
Yet.
Yeah.
But we're there almost.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is about having sensors. What allows this is being able to put sensors on people and that they forget about the sensors.
Yeah.
Which is also what we want to do with patients. We want to put sensors on them, but we don't want them to feel them or to think about the sensors, because then you start acting differently.
Mm.
Both in patients trying to walk, if I ask a patient to walk as normal as possible, but they know that they have this thing on their arms or on their legs, then they want to walk normally.
Mm. But in the beginning, I guess they will walk, they will be very aware, but then after some time they forget.
Right? We want them to forget about the sensors. Mm-hmm. And that's what we say in the music lab, forget about the sensor.
We'll
put it in and then you forget about it for the next 2 hours.
Yeah. Okay, so this has been great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Victor Gonzalez, for sharing your knowledge about sensors and human movement and also Latin American music. You have one more song that we're going to finish off with.
Yeah, this is Buena Vista Social Club.
Ah.
Chan Chan.
Great. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.
Llego a puesto, voy para más.